Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The latest jobless numbers out today show that the nation's unemployment rate held steady last month at 9.6%. That means the unemployment rate has been above 9.5% for the longest stretch since the 1930s. While some private companies were hiring, the overall economy lost 95,000 jobs in September, mostly teachers and other government workers. It's the last job report before voters go to the polls next month, and it will likely have implications for the midterm elections. President Obama said today that the growth in the private sector is encouraging, and he said private hiring has been up for 9 consecutive months. Joining us from Washington is Michael Shear, who covers politics for the New York Times. And Michael, Democrats and Republicans are looking at these numbers very differently. Can you sketch out their arguments for us? First, how are the Republicans interpreting them?
The Republicans are doing well this election season in part because they've been able to tap into the anger that folks have over the economy, the jobless situation, a lot of people out of work. And so when a report like this comes out, the Republicans tend to focus on the overall number, the overall direction of jobs. Obviously, you know, an overall loss in the number of people working in the economy and a really high unemployment rate that, you know, has been a drag on the fortunes for politicians that are in office right now. You know, within moments of the numbers coming out today, there were already press releases going out to reporters, hammering the idea that under the watch of President Obama and the Democrats who control Congress, this is the situation we have.
Mm-hmm. And the Democrats?
Well, the Democrats are going to try to dig down into some of the details. You know, the president likes to say, look, after losing nearly 4 million jobs in the latter part of the Bush administration, the number of jobs, especially in the private sector, I think, has been close to 800,000-900,000 jobs gained in the private sector. Now, that's been offset to a little extent by the public sector, you know, states, local governments laying off people as well. But so the Democrats focus on, look, you know, we've gained some of those jobs back. We've started to turn the corner. The president likes to say it's been a deep hole, so digging out of that hole is going to take a long time. But they sort of make a keep on this path and let's not go back to the policies that put us here. That's the Democratic argument.
Mm, so basically the Republicans got us into this mess is what they're saying.
Indeed.
Mm. Now, the president seems to have been modulating his message a little bit. He told crowds this week that he's impatient with the pace of the economic recovery. Do you think he's going to stick with that message?
Yeah, you know, I think if you go back a couple of decades to some of the criticism against the first President Bush, that he somehow was out of touch with the way folks were feeling in the recession of the early 90s, that lesson has been learned by politicians today. And so President Obama and his aides are very quick to say, look, we know this isn't fast enough. We know that folks are frustrated. President Obama always says, I'm frustrated too. But that said, their basic message is going to be, we can't go back to the old policies. We have to keep on the path that we're going. And, you know, listen, that's their message, and they're going to stick to it for the next few weeks.
Hmm. But people, as you said, are frustrated. They're angry. I think that they may just be looking for change and change in a quicker pace.
Right. And, you know, look, I mean, the bottom line here is that the Democrats won so many seats in Congress that maybe they weren't even expected to win in the last couple of cycles in 2006 and in 2008. They're in power now. So all of that pent-up anger, the frustration that people feel, they're out of work or a friend is out of work or they're struggling to pay their mortgage, all of that is sort of directed at Washington, directed at the people in power. And right now, there are more Democrats in power.
Hmm. And if we look at today's unemployment report from the Labor Department, which shows that a lot of these jobs lost were teachers and other local government workers, I think some folks might say, well, what about the money that Congress approved back in August to save teachers and government workers' jobs? Didn't that help?
Right. Well, and it's unclear yet. I think that's one of the things that we're going to see play out over the next, you know, few days is how much of that money. It was $26 billion. The president had fought for it. He signed it in mid-August. A lot of that money was supposed to go to teachers and school districts around the country to kind of help stave off this kind of job loss. Now, what we don't know is, would the job losses at states and local governments have been even larger had this money not been approved, or is there somehow a reason why local governments, local school districts haven't been able to use that money to kind of avoid the layoffs that we've seen. Maybe they're going to use them for future budgets. Clearly, that's going to be a question that a lot of people are going to be asking.
Mm-hmm. So basically, the economy will continue to be a big issue, and both sides will have their take on it, and it'll be up to the voters to decide, but the voters are angry.
Yeah, and in essence, if there was any hope that the Democrats might have been harboring that the unemployment rate was going to come down significantly or that there would be a really positive jobs report that they could sort of end strong on, that was sort of dashed today.
Hmm. Michael Shear, chief political reporter for the Caucus blog at the New York Times, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure, anytime.
When General David Petraeus, now overseeing military operations in Afghanistan, was on this Here and Now program several years ago, he talked about the importance of his non-military experience, the time he spent at Princeton, where he received a doctorate degree. Well, our next guest says that General Petraeus was fortunate because the military's outdated promotion policy often discourages the kind of outside-the-box experience that Petraeus got at Princeton. Rennie McPherson is now a graduate student at the Harvard Business School. He also served as a Marine officer in Iraq in 2006, and he later worked for the RAND Corporation as an analyst in Iraq. You can read his op-ed on this issue at hereandnow.org as he joins me in the studio. And Rennie, when you were at RAND, you interviewed more than three dozen military leaders, some of them three and four-star generals, and they echoed General Petraeus about the importance of opportunities outside of the mainstream military. But they also said they were discouraged from seeking them.
That is right, and that's what I gleaned from the interviews with these leaders who had successfully commanded in combat and complex environments. That's what they themselves said, that they felt as though some of the experiences they had on the way up, their way up the military command chain, that were most valuable are those that are least appreciated by the military promotion system and, when they were younger officers, by their immediate superiors in many cases. If they wanted to, you know, take on a job as a UN observer, try and get civilian graduate education, or a number of other jobs, even working as a staffer in the Pentagon, which a lot of military people kind of don't necessarily want to do, they want to be out in the field, but they argued, and I sort of see it as well, as the military's reluctance to reward these types of decisions has been problematic.
I wonder, you say that you go to school with, what, about two dozen other veterans at Harvard, and many of them are not interested in returning to the military to become leaders.
Of my class year at the business school, I have over 30 veterans. There are over 30 veterans that are first years at the school. So that's over 60. And at Harvard, there are a number of other veterans at the Kennedy School, which is the policy school, and the other graduate schools. However, I would not say that they are not interested in returning to the military. In fact, after the article, I had a couple of heartfelt conversations with people who did want to return to the military, were able to get accepted into Harvard Business School, and then told their commands, I want to go get this experience. I want to go interact with future leaders of foreign countries, future leaders of major industry, people that understand macroeconomics and economic systems. And the response they got, unfortunately, was, you can't do that. That's not going to help you get promoted. That's going to throw off your promotion schedule. There are isolated incidents of young officers being able to do this, to go get a policy degree. In many cases, business degree would be less common, but there is not. It's very hit or miss, and it's mostly miss whether young officers are allowed to do this.
Hmm. So, do you think that the U.S. military is losing a lot of potential good, solid leaders?
I think that there are a lot of great young leaders that have already demonstrated that they're interested in joining the military. It's easy to say that in the United States, a lot of smart and ambitious people don't join the military, but that's very different than people that have already given between 4 and 10 years of their lives to the military. And if these people, some of my classmates, want to stay in the military, but know that they need to broaden their minds, broaden their worldviews and experiences by something like civilian graduate education, and the military doesn't allow them to do that, then they have been lost. They already have been. It's happening.
You know, there were some comments about your piece on the Globe website. One reader said, there are a lot of visionary commanders on their way up the ranks in the military. You just haven't met them. What do you say to that?
What my hope would be, and that what I hope this the reader that you refer to understands, is we have a lot of talented, intelligent, motivated officers. The military system needs to allow these people to go do something a little bit different so that they don't wind up as senior generals who haven't had these broadening experiences which will make them able to lead at the most strategic, the biggest picture level.
So you would advocate for more comprehensive training of folks who are already leading in the military to allow things like civilian graduate school or things like that, so they could, in fact, have a broader level of experiences to be effective leaders.
I would argue that the rules and regulations should allow for more of these types of experiences. And also, part of the reason I wrote the article was I wanted to put the issue on the table, and hopefully a number of mid-level and senior officers have read it. And my hope is that it will resonate with their understanding of how much weight is put on senior leaders. And if they need to be commanding a massive military organization, worried about the logistics of that, worried about interacting with a number of foreign peers, worried about political aspects, economic aspects, as Stanley McChrystal unfortunately understood, you know, with a, you know, much more scrutiny in the media every day, every year. And as a result, that not only the rules and regulations change, but also senior leaders and mid-level leaders allow those officers and those enlisted personnel who are under their command to go get one of these experiences that could be very valuable to the military when that person has progressed 10 or 15 years down the line.
Hmm. Will you return to the military?
Like many of my peers at graduate school, I am not going to return to the military. To me, the decision was made a while ago that I wanted to serve for my 4 years and leave active duty. But the issue I had is with the people that actually did want to return to the military and found that they just were unable to balance their desire to go get an expanding, broadening experience with staying within the expectations of their commanders and their supervisors within the military.
All right. Rennie McPherson served as Marine officer in Anbar Province, Iraq in 2006. He's now a graduate student at the Harvard Business School. His op-ed on military leadership appeared in the Boston Globe. We'll link you to that at hereandnow.org. Rennie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
And just ahead, taking stock of antiquities in war-ravaged Iraq. We'll be back in a minute. Here and Now. Welcome back. As U.S. combat troops make their way home from Iraq, some of the ancient Iraqi artifacts looted during the U.S.-led invasion are heading back to Baghdad. You may remember those chaotic weeks just as U.S. forces entered Iraq in the spring of 2003 when there was rampant looting at the Iraq National Museum in Baghdad, one of the world's largest collections of Middle Eastern art. The U.S. was blamed for not stopping the theft, and in April of 2003, then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made light of the looting at a press conference.
The images you are seeing on television, you are seeing over and over, and it's the same picture of some person walking out of some building with a vase. And you see it 20 times. And you think, my goodness, were there that many vases? Is it possible that there were that many vases in the whole country?
Well, we now know that more than 15,000 artifacts were stolen from the museum. One of the most prized was a 4,400-year-old statue of Sumerian King Entemena. It was missing for 3 years, and finally it returned to Baghdad last month. One of the people who helped the statue get home is Professor John Russell. He's a professor of art history at the Massachusetts College of Art, and he served as cultural advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. He continues to advise the State Department about Iraqi antiquities. And John, when the State Department first called you in May of 2003, they said it was urgent. They said, we need you to go to Iraq, and can you go today?
That's true. I had a hint that there was a mission coming, but not that I might be asked to be on it. And I think I had 3 hours to buy a ticket and get to the airport, which is, I still am amazed that I was able to do that.
Oh, my gosh. And so, and you've gone out there, and a lot of your research focused on the Baghdad National Museum and this statue in particular of a former Iraqi king.
My work focused on the museum, improving the facility of the museum, trying to locate collections and that sort of thing. I wasn't particularly looking for the statue of the Sumerian king, but we knew it was out there, and we were hearing rumors from some of the MPs that were tracking down looted museum pieces that it was out there, but they just couldn't get a handle on it. And it was only a couple of years after I got back that he surfaced, apparently in Syria.
He being the statue of King Entemena.
I'm sorry, I speak of him as a person because I feel that we've been acquainted for a while, even though, of course, he's my superior. He's a king, after all. But the statue itself was considered alive by the Sumerians, by the king who created it, King Entemena, who inscribed it with the words that the statue would speak to his people and to his god, and, of course, they speak to us. It originally would have been about 3 feet. He's missing his head, and that's a pretty serious loss. So he's about 30 inches now, but he's a very solid black stone that was in antiquity imported from the Persian Gulf. So the stone was a special rare stone that the king bragged about having brought in for this statue. And it is heavy, over 300 pounds.
And so looters somehow got that out of the museum in 2003. In 2006, you hear that this statue has surfaced in Syria. I'm assuming some sort of art underworld kind of a thing where someone was, what, trying to sell it? Or what was happening?
The MPs that we worked with said that whenever you steal something like Entemena, of course, it doesn't occur to you at the time that you'll never be able to sell it. But they don't think that. And so you flush it out by indicating you might want to buy it. As I understand it, some inquiries from U.S. Customs in New York managed to locate someone who knew where the statue was, and that someone managed to move the statue into a location where it could be seized by U.S. Customs, and then it was in New York. My first encounter directly with the statue after it was stolen was when I was invited down to watch it be unpacked and to confirm that it was actually that piece.
How long did it take you to confirm that it was the real thing?
As soon as the packing came off. I mean, it's a unique piece.
So you knew immediately.
There's nothing like it.
And in addition to the statue, you dealt with a collection of clay tablets, which were looted from Iraq before the war. They were seized by U.S. Customs agents in 2001, and they were stored in a vault in the basement of the World Trade Center, almost destroyed on 9/11, but rescued shortly afterward. Can you tell me about them?
This tablet project is one of the most exciting projects that I've been involved with. It was about 300 cuneiform clay tablets, mostly from about 2000 or so BC, that when the customs agents and I were able to review them for the first time, which was several years after they had been rescued from the Trade Center, they were starting to fall apart. So we developed a project in coordination with the Iraqi embassy in Washington to conserve the tablets, to send them to professional conservators, actually in Cambridge at the Semitic Museum, where they were baked, soaked to get all the salts out of them, and then repaired. And it turns out that about half of them belong to an important archive that tells us a lot that we didn't previously know about a particular governor and his activities in southern Iraq around 2000.
And why is it important for us to know these things and to preserve these artifacts?
In the case of ancient Iraq, we really don't know anything at all about Iraq except what we've gotten from the archaeological record, from tablets like these and from careful excavations at ancient cities throughout the country. There are no original documents that have been transmitted other than those that have been recovered that way. Hmm. So everything we know comes from this information.
Right. How much Iraqi art do you think is still missing?
The big unreported or underreported problem with Iraqi art, Iraqi ancient art now, is the continuing and previously horrible problem of archaeological site looting. And there's no way really, except by sort of watching the market, to determine how big that problem is. The Iraq Museum has recovered over 30,000 objects that weren't previously in its collection. So at least that many pieces have been recovered abroad and from within the country. And that can only be the tip of the iceberg. So probably hundreds of thousands of pieces are out of the country and circulating from archaeological sites, and then another maybe 10,000 pieces are still missing from the museum's original collections.
So you're going to be busy for a very long time.
There's still a lot to do.
All right. Well, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John Russell is a professor of art history at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design. He advises the State Department on how to preserve art in Iraq. The controversy surrounding France's crackdown on the Roma people, or gypsies, stretched to the Vatican today, where French President Nicolas Sarkozy met with Pope Benedict. Sarkozy's government has linked the Roma to crime, and he's deported about 1,000 people back to Romania and Bulgaria. Many Roman Catholics have criticized that, and the Pope appeared to weigh in on the controversy with a subtle message about tolerance this past summer. So today's visit by Sarkozy was seen as some fence mending. The French president has said that France has every right to expel people he says can't support themselves. But what about the Roma who are earning a living in France, including musicians who've been entertaining Parisians for years? As the BBC's Christian Fraser reports, the curtain may be coming down on Europe's last gypsy circus.
With trumpets and violins, jugglers and dancers, the Cirque Romanes has been entertaining Parisian crowds for decades. They are musicians from all over Europe, so talented that earlier this year they were paid to represent France at the World Expo in Shanghai. But suddenly they find themselves in the midst of the government's concerted campaign to expel hundreds of illegal Roma gypsies. The Labour Ministry has refused Alexandre Romanes, the French circus owner, the work permits he requires for his top Romanian musicians.
We are, I think, the only gypsy circus in the world. It's a bit of a shame. They accuse us of putting our children on the streets to beg. We'll just do that then, beg and steal. What can we do?
At the end of each show, the musicians retire to their caravans. But this is hardly one of the 300 makeshift camps President Sarkozy had in his sights. It's clean, swept every day, and anyone who lives here works hard to earn their money. The immigration minister denies there's any political motivation to close the circus. He's responding, he says, to a Labour Ministry report that accuses Mr. Romanes of underpaying his musicians. They also question his use of child performers, including his own daughter Rose, who loves to dance. Violinist Vasil Constantin Costabiță, who fled Romania in the 1980s to escape the Ceausescu regime, says the circus is all his family has ever known.
My father, my mother, my brothers were all musicians. That's all we've ever done. I am 60 years old. I can't do anything else other than play the violin. That's what I've done all my life. Now if the circus stops, what am I going to do at 60? What can I do? I've been working here for 16 years. If it stops, the French government will ask me to go back to Romania.
Mr. Romanes is a descendant of the Buglioni family, a big name in the circus world. The Buglioni was travelling Europe in the mid-19th century. Alexandre dislikes the term Roma. He prefers to be known as a gypsy, though his wife Delia says the discrimination is the same, whatever title you prefer.
I feel it now. I didn't feel it like that before in France, and it worries me. There is still diversity, good and bad, like everywhere else. But really, at the moment, I find the same atmosphere as in Romania when I left at the age of 15. I don't know what it is, but an atmosphere of denunciation, a feeling of hatred, spite from some people.
The circus has now begun an online petition. So far, they've gathered 13,000 signatures. And this week, they put on a night of performance for all those who wanted to give their support. Three shows attended by hundreds of people from across the city. This is the last gypsy circus in Europe, possibly in the world. But unless the Labour Ministry looks more favourably on his petition, the big top of the Romanes Circus might soon be lowered for the very last time.
That report from the BBC's Christian Fraser in Paris. Be sure to visit our website, hereandnow.org, today, where we have several web extras for you. You can see photos of the 4,400-year-old statue of King Entemena. We spoke about him earlier today in our story on looted art being returned to museums in Iraq. You can also see a slideshow and listen to music from our upcoming story about an opera that's premiering this weekend. And we'll be back after a break. It's Here and Now. The home foreclosure mess in the United States is getting even messier. Today, the nation's largest bank, Bank of America, said it's stopping sales of foreclosed homes in all 50 states as it reviews potentially flawed foreclosure documents. Concern is growing that mortgage lenders have been evicting homeowners using fraudulent documents. State and federal officials have been pressing the mortgage industry about potential violations. And of course, this has big implications for the already fragile real estate market. Foreclosed home sales make up about a third of all home sales in the country. Well, joining us is Benjamin Applebaum. He's financial reporter for the New York Times. And Benjamin, I'm wondering, can you tell me how significant is this announcement today from Bank of America?
This is a big deal. This is the largest bank in the country, the largest mortgage lender. And it is essentially saying we're not going to be doing any more foreclosures for the foreseeable future. It's going to put a lot of pressure on other banks to follow. There's already tremendous political pressure building on those institutions. I think we're likely to see the wheels of foreclosure grinding to a halt.
Hmm. Now, this was all prompted by stories of flawed paperwork in foreclosure cases, some astonishing stories. We heard from one Bank of America executive who said in a deposition that she signed as many as 8,000 foreclosure documents a month without reviewing them. And, of course, we heard about these electronic signatures or robo-signing. Is that the focus of the problem, really?
You know, this has been building for years. For years now, there have been allegations in state courts across the country that banks were cutting corners, cheating on paperwork, failing to properly follow the laws concerning the ownership of property. And this has just built to a critical mass where the number of allegations and in some of the vivid details, like the ones you just described, have created a national outcry concerning what appears to be a fairly systemic problem.
Hmm. So is there any idea, really, of how many mortgages might be affected? Is it the majority of them?
We don't know how many mortgages were handled improperly or in how many cases banks... the core of this issue is the question of whether... When a bank made a mortgage and then transferred it to an investor or another bank, whether that transfer was done properly and legally, which needed to be the case in order for the eventual holder to foreclose on a property. We don't know how many loans were transferred improperly, but some of the stories that we're hearing, you know, as you just said, about thousands of signatures being forged or done electronically or done by people who never reviewed paperwork, the same name being signed in several different ways, suggests that this was business as usual, that banks did this routinely, that these are not exceptions, but that this type of conduct really became the rule.
Hmm. So then are there several cases where there's a question of who actually owns the property?
That is the fundamental question here, is whether, legally speaking, ownership of these properties was properly transferred from the entity that made the original mortgage loan, a bank or a mortgage lender, a mortgage broker, up the chain of ownership through the hands of other banks and through Wall Street's hands into one of these mortgage-backed securities that investors own pieces of, whether at every step in that process ownership was properly transferred. So, you know, what courts want to know when they're foreclosing on a property is, do you have the right to take this home away from the person living in it? Do you own it? And the answer to that question in many cases appears to be, I thought I owned it, but I can't really prove it.
So, and we should say in about half of the states, foreclosures go to court, but in half of them, they do not. So initially, we were dealing with cases that were in court. Were judges then, if this was sort of the standard operating procedure for lenders to go through, were judges realizing that these documents weren't carefully reviewed and letting the process go forward anyway, and that's changing now?
That seems to be the case, that in that there were judges who, it certainly is the case, that there were judges who were allowing these issues, who were allowing foreclosures to proceed despite these issues, who were signing off on foreclosures in cases where homeowners and their attorneys pointed out these kinds of problems. And it's interesting because, you know, in some sense, what we're talking about here are technicalities. No one doubts that the bank loaned the money. No one doubts that the homeowner failed to repay it. In some sense, the bank surely is entitled to the property. But what has changed is the climate. There's this growing frustration that banks have done next to nothing to prevent foreclosures or to help homeowners. And people have been frustrated that banks have routinely, you know, relied on the letter of the law in arguing that they should get to keep their bonuses and arguing that they should, you know, be exempt from various requirements. Now, all of a sudden, we have a law that seems to, you know, favor the homeowners, and people are seizing on it and sort of rubbing some of the bank's medicine back into their own faces.
So does this mean for folks facing foreclosure that the process will likely be delayed for some time to come and that they have a way to at least stay in their homes, if not try to prevent the foreclosure from happening?
In the short term, absolutely. I mean, Bank of America's announcement today plainly means that, that people whose loan is held by Bank of America are going to be able to stay in their homes. And as other lenders take similar steps, it will preserve many people in their homes for months to come.
And what about the folks who are trying to buy distressed properties? Because there were people who were getting lured back into the housing market with low interest rates and with lower prices. What does this mean for them?
Well, that's a really good question, because as always with our broken housing market, every action has ripple effects. And we've been in this long-term process of resetting the housing market, allowing prices to drop, putting people into homes who can actually afford them. And the flip side of this coin is that that process is now going to grind to a halt as well. Homes are not going to be sold. Prices are not going to drop as easily. People are not going to be able to move into new homes, even though other people are going to be able to stay in the ones that they have.
We also have a class action lawsuit which focuses on a company known as MERS, Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems. Can you briefly explain that?
Yeah, MERS is basically a company that was created by the industry to facilitate the electronic transfer of ownership of mortgage loans. It's a database, it's a registry, it's a place where this information is recorded and kept track of. And the question is whether using that kind of database satisfies the legal requirements for transferring ownership of a mortgage. What we're basically dealing with here is a very old set of laws that require most things to be done by hand, in ink, on paper, and an industry that got tired of following those laws and increasingly did things electronically, expeditiously, without taking the time to make sure that it was still complying with those laws. That conflict is going to have to be resolved one way or the other.
All right. And we've got state and federal investigations that will look at all of it. So,
yeah,
Benjamin Applebaum, financial reporter for The New York Times, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Welcome back. Our next story is a story about two composers, both Western, both devoted to the music of Bali. Canadian composer Colin McPhee was one of the first Westerners to write about the unique sound of the traditional Balinese gamelan, an orchestra made of drums, gongs, and metallophones. American composer Evan Zaporin shares McPhee's fascination with the music. He's written an opera based on McPhee's memoir, A House in Bali. In it, McPhee tells the story of his life with the Balinese during the 1930s and his friendships with Margaret Mead and German artist Walter Spies. The opera, also called A House in Bali, features Western and Balinese orchestras and singers.
Thank you.
The opera's been performed in Bali and in California. Tonight, it premieres here in Boston. We caught up with Zaborn during a recent rehearsal at MIT, where he teaches. In this scene, tenor Peter Tansitz, who plays the role of McPhee, is trying to convince the Balinese that he should live among them in the village. I asked Zaporin to explain why McPhee's request to live in a village was such a big deal.
Well, at that time, Bali had only been open to the West for a couple of decades, and most of the Westerners that were there were Dutch administrators. It was a Dutch colony. McPhee was one of the first Westerners to live in the villages. Some of the villagers didn't like it. They thought it was an encroachment on their traditional lifestyle, and they also felt that anybody who lived in the village should be contributing to the village in some way. And what's important about that is that it was in that scene, which is described really vividly in the book, that McPhee kind of learned something about the Balinese way of doing things. And even though, in a sense, he's being barricaded in his own house and kind of being shaken down, he's also realizing that he has to work with the villagers if he's going to stay there rather than just running to the colonial authorities anytime he gets in trouble.
Why else should people know the story of Colin McPhee?
Well, McPhee opened the door to having a kind of profound contact with another culture in a way that very few people had done up until that point. At least in music before then, some people were aware of gamelan, for example, but it was very much a peering at it through the glass, if you will. He was the one who really went there and just regarded it as, you know, as serious and as deep a music as our music. It felt that it needed, you know, was worthy of that kind of attention. And, you know, now we live in an age where everybody knows what world music is, and everybody, nobody blinks if you combine, you know, an Australian didgeridoo with an Indian sitar with, you know, a Western orchestra, right? With a rapper. You know, that's, tell me something I don't know, right? But McPhee was really the first to do that. And I just think about what a leap that was to give up everything he had and give up everything he had been taught based on a couple scratchy 78s that he heard, you know, in 1929. I think that's a really incredible thing.
There's an uncomfortable part in the opera, really, where about the relationship between Colin McPhee and a Balinese boy. There's a song, we have a clip that I'd like to listen to, where Spies is actually trying to help lure the boy work for McPhee.
Boy, little man, this man, my good friend Colin, has a motor car with its own house called a garage. If you lived here and worked for him, peeling onions and tending to the ducks, my good friend Colin might be persuaded to take you out of this village, to take you for a ride.
McPhee's book describes these scenes in almost the exact way that we present them in the opera. Almost 90% of the libretto actually is straight from the book. And the book presents this in as direct and as innocent a way as is possible. But that's what happens, and that was not uncommon. I mean, Sampi was a small boy, and McPhee, like many Westerners at the time, took him into his household. When he met him, he was completely fascinated by him. And he did bring his parents to his house and basically get them to agree to let the boy live with him. After that, and this is what's important, he educated him. He taught him to be a dancer, and Sampi, in fact, went on to become not only a famous dancer in Bali, but the first Balinese dancer to come to America and danced on Broadway in the 1950s and danced in Las Vegas. To me, what's interesting about the story of McPhee and Sompi is has nothing to do with whatever overtones might be there, but with the way that McPhee projected onto Sompi exactly what he had projected onto the culture. He heard Balinese music and he thought it was beautiful and pure and innocent, and in other writings he described it as feeling like he was seeing the world when it was young, and he wanted to protect it, he wanted to nurture it, he wanted to somehow be a part of it. And then he began to get disillusioned with the direction the music was going in. Basically, he went through the exact same process with this boy as he went through with the culture. And to me, it's more about that metaphor than anything else.
In the music, you've got gamelan, mm-hmm. and you've got Western contemporary music. Putting those together, is that part of the same metaphor almost?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it's all about. And that's my connection to McPhee, because I also heard Balinese music when I was 20. McPhee was a little older, and I had the same response McPhee did, though I knew nothing about him. I just found this music really amazing and really familiar and yet so distant and strange. I had to find out what it was all about. And then I had to come back and figure out what to do with my own music. And in a way, this opera puts it all together for me, because I have a full gamelan, I have my own ensemble, Bang in a Can, from New York. I've got Western opera singers, and I've got Balinese traditional singers who, as you heard, sing in a really different way. And so the music gives a frame to the story.
That's composer Evan Zipporin. His opera, A House in Bali, will be performed tonight and tomorrow in Boston before it heads to New York. This is also from the opera. It's called Ketchak, or Monkey Chant. To hear more from A House in Bali or see pictures and hear one of my favorites from the rehearsal, go to our website, hereandnow.org.